What's up, what's up? Welcome to another episode of the Digital and Social Media Sports Podcast. I am your host, Neil Horwitz. You can find me on Twitter, NJH287, on LinkedIn, where I post more content. Hit me up there. The website, dsmsports.net, and of course, listen to the podcast, follow on whichever podcast platform is your favorite. It is a best of episode for y'all today. Again, I try to do these once a quarter because there's so much to catch up on. Barely sneaking this one into the third quarter of 2023. Just got finished not too long ago celebrating 10 years of the podcast, trying to get caught up with all the best ofs because there's just so many good conversations that we don't have over the years. And whether you are new to the podcast or you've been somehow listening since 10 years ago, there's likely some episodes that are worth re-listening to, or certainly ones, interviews that you should listen to if you haven't heard them before, because again, just an all-star roster of people I've been able to talk to over the years. So here's what you're going to hear from today. You're going to hear from six different guests, about 10 to 15 minutes, give or take, of each interview. Just give you a taste, some of the best stuff, and then you can decide if you want to listen to the full thing. Of course, all of these are awesome. This collection of guests today is just amazing. I look back and just relish the conversations. Being able to listen back to them as I pulled out the clips was awesome. So first up, you're going to hear from JB Greer. He is Director of Player Marketing, working with all the baseball players at Octagon. Then, followed by JB Greer, is Emily Miller. She is currently at FanDuel. When I talked to her, she was at NYRA, the New York Racing Association, which is where like the Belmont Stakes are, and we go in a lot of sports betting talk. Followed by Emily is Jenny Fisher. She has worked with the WNBA, she's worked with the G League, NCAA, spent a lot of time at Marquette when she was an undergrad there working with their athletics department. Now she's with the NBA doing social and digital, so she is awesome. Followed by Jenny, you'll hear from Marissa Mast. When I spoke with Marissa, she was at the Arizona Coyotes and does a great job going in on their digital and social. Now she's working with brands and public figures doing social. Followed by Marissa will be Kareem Fatih. He is with Sport5. VP of digital there, and just amazing insight on fan development. Sport5, one of the biggest agencies of their type in the sports industry for sure. And Kareem does a great job in their digital department. Lastly, will be Tyson Hutchins. Can't say enough good stuff about Tyson. He is truly becoming a thought leader in the space. If not, they're one of the top already. He is associate AD creative strategy at BYU, working with their athletics programs department. And he previously there, he was at Clemson and just has so much good things to say. He's really articulate and thoughtful about the space. So again, just a phenomenal list of guests you'll hear from today in this best of episode. So to start off, batting leadoff, yes, pun very much intended. Listen up to JB Greer. We talk about, he's Director of Player Marketing for baseball at Octagon, the agency they're working with several athletes in particular in this case. And we talk about building the brand of baseball players and the challenges and opportunities for them, what it's like to get the social media adoption and the strategy there. JB plays a key role in helping to educate, inform, and facilitate these players, building their brands and landing deals and making the most of their time in the spotlight and thereafter. So listen up. Here's a bit of my conversation with JB Greer.
When we sit down, we pitch not only your contract agent, but we also have a staff that helps with your financial planning. We have a certified accountant on staff to help you with your taxes. You have myself and another person on our staff who works on your marketing. We have full support staff in the office, like office managers and coordinators that help with your equipment and your travel and your, shipping your car across the country and your insurance and paying your bills. Like anything that you could think of, we probably have the human capital to help you with it. So, and I think a lot of agencies are similar in that. And I think from there, it kind of comes down to culture and who you get along with, and much similar to interviewing for a job, like we talked about, when you're interviewing with an agent, us as agents have to put our best foot forward, and it's kind of on you. Like, who do you get along with best? Who do you see yourself best? Who do you want to help guide your career, hopefully forever? And that's who you sign with. So yeah, I mean, full service means just about anything you could possibly think of.
Definitely cool stuff, and it really is the speed dial for players or athletes for everything they could possibly need to manage their lives and help make some money while they're in the spotlight and having this great career. I'd love to hear, I think we often think of maybe it's give me the most money. I want you to, you know, take the highest bid or whatever it might be. But I think, you know, when it comes to what you do and working with brands, trying to get deals for the clients of Octagon, in the Octagon baseball department, how much is it, hey, I want to maximize the revenue this guy makes or the income this guy makes, versus I want to make sure that I'm matching him with the brands and companies and missions that he believes in, that's really important to him. And does it vary a lot among the athletes that you guys work with, that some just, you know, want as many deals as possible because they want to, you know, make that bag, while others are much more discerning with who they're going to be working with?
I think both are super important, and I think they're important to different guys. I mean, again, you're teeing me up here. Everything you're asking is spot on. But yeah, some guys in their careers, you know, especially in baseball, after you're grinding through the minor leagues and you're on a fixed salary for your first three seasons, a lot of times money is really important, and you can sacrifice, you know, some of your personal brand authenticity in order to get more money off the field. And that's totally fine. But I think as you'll see guys go through their careers and you become a free agent and you sign for the bag and you're making $100 million, you know, you're not as concerned about standing in front of a green screen and saying cheesy lines to get a couple extra dollars. You know, you can start to decline those deals. And that's when you're seeing now guys are turning to equity partners and trying to leverage these deals to become owners and set themselves up, you know, not just for a quick payday for a couple extra dollars, but, you know, for the rest of their career and to turn themselves into businessmen and investors. And I think that's really the future of our business, is bringing on athletes as partners. And the word partners and partnerships has been used for a long time, but I think in order to be a true partnership, the athlete should have some sort of skin in the game. And I think that's the future of it. But yeah, you're exactly right. And some guys, you know, it's much more important for them to, I guess, manage and grow their personal brand and put them with the right companies that align with them. That's a lot more important than just to sign a contract and, you know, again, stand in front of a screen and get a couple of thousand dollars. So every player is different, and we certainly approach it that way. It's very much an individualistic approach. And, you know, some guys need certain things. Some guys, you know, don't need that. And it's our job to really learn from them and put them in the best place to succeed.
Really great point. There's so many different directions I want to go from that. I guess let's get through this question, because I won't be able to ask it again later, most likely. But you made a great point about how really a lot of these guys do toil in the minors, and you know that helps cultivate some humility. But most of these guys don't become millionaires overnight, like you may see in the NBA and the NFL. I mean, yes, some of them make some good money on that initial signing bonus, but you know it's going to be at least 2-3 years, even for the best guys, to make it to the big leagues and get in that biggest of big spotlights. So how does that affect, you know, how baseball players are marketed? Is there an understanding that, hey, you're not going to necessarily be, there's only so many guys that can be Bryce Harper from day one? You know, it's a marathon, not a sprint. We're not going to, you know, max out on day one. So how does that affect the way that you guys are able to market your players? And is that almost something that you need to overcome in baseball, and something that's holding baseball players back from being on those top Q rating lists that some of the other athletes might be earlier on in their careers?
This is what we could probably spend an hour on. So I think this is the money question. But yeah, you're 100% right in that. That is a big, you know, reason that baseball players are falling behind in market share, marketability, and, you know, publicity ratings and all those things, is that for the peak of their time in terms of their youth, their adolescence, the times when they're, you know, grinding, working out, going out, having fun, ages, let's say you go out of high school, ages 18 to 22 or 23, every other league, you're in the pros. You know, you go straight from high school to the league, or you go straight from college to the league, and you're on TV every night. And that's really important because you get that exposure. You're in your pro contract, you're on TV every night, and that's, you know, you don't have that time in between that baseball has. From you go from the peak of your life and your career to getting drafted, and then you go sit on a bus in Iowa for 3 hours, you know, or if you're lucky, 3 hours. So yeah, I think there's that period between when you're drafted or signed and then when you're called up, and that period, you know, is really, really hard to capture that and turn that into content. And I think that's what's going to be crucial for baseball, is how do we turn that into content? And the idea I've always tried to pitch is, like, you know, how do we take that time and turn it into some last chance you type of content? You know, these guys that are riding the bus, that are future superstars, and even guys that have signed for millions of dollars, they're still riding the bus, you know, like they're still stuck in single A, double A, triple A, all the way until the majors. Then they're called up and they have this huge moment, but nobody really knows who they are. So, and you really have to perform to get recognized and to grow nationally. So, yeah, there's a huge gap in time. And I think that's, you know, it really is a challenge to find ways to get guys marketed while they're in that time period. But I think that, like with anything, technology and social media is going to make that easier. It's just, you know, we got to find the right platform and the right media outlets to, you know, showcase those guys. And there's just not a lot out there right now. So yeah. Trevor Bauer and his team is trying to build it with momentum. And, you know, I'm a huge fan of momentum. And, you know, we've done some content with our guys. But outside of that, like, if he didn't create that on his own, we'd still be sitting in the same position. So we just need more people to take chances and to showcase that, and for the players themselves to turn that time period into a time in which they're making content and comfortable doing it.
Yeah, no, I love the way you kind of almost flip it around. It can be a feature, not a bug, to have all those years when you are, you know, grinding it out and, you know, maybe having a part-time job in the off season. And all that time in hotels, on buses, at the ballpark, that's time that, yes, you're working on your game, you're watching video, you're studying analytics, whatever it might be. But you can also create content. You can create some crazy TikToks, whatever, on the bus. You can do some live streams. You can interact with fans, engage with fans, and meet people at that level. So I love the idea of embracing that grind and turning it into something that's marketable and that humanizes the players even more. That's what we talk about so much. It's how can you relate to players on a human level? And it can start from day one.
Yeah. And I think, but again, like with anything, being individualistic, that word has been killing me all day. But, you know, the same way, that's not for everybody. You know, it right. takes a certain level of confidence and comfort and outgoingness to make a TikTok when you're on the bus in Arkansas, or to get to the stadium and pull out your phone and try to make cute videos before a game. Because also, like, in those situations, that's super stressful and super cutthroat. Those guys are fighting for their lives to try to climb the ladder and ultimately make it to the show. And then when you get to the show, you got to stay 6 years until you get your free agency check. So it's just hard. You know, I think it's a culture barrier. And I think that, you know, you have to have this certain type of personality to be comfortable to pull a phone out and try to be cute on the bus when everybody's, you know, grinding and sleeping and watching videos, like you're saying. So, yeah, I think it's tough. It's going to take the right guy, but I think, you know, the opportunity is certainly there for the guys that have the personality for it.
What are the biggest objections? And this is something I talked about. I had on the podcast recently, Amobi Okugo, who played in the MLS and plays in the USL, and he was talking about how some players do embrace it, some players don't, and you're echoing that as well. Are some players legitimately worried that, hey, you know, the boss man, the GM, whoever, will see this, and I may not get called up before the other guy because he sees it on, maybe he thinks I'm screwing around on TikTok too much and not taking extra BP or whatever it might be. What are the biggest objections? Or maybe other guys are just too shy, too timid, or some guys may not speak the language really well if they're coming from outside the States. What are the biggest objections that you guys tend to hear? And do you present it as an opportunity, or at the point that they reach you guys at Octagon, are guys almost either inclined to do that stuff or they're not?
Yeah, I think the biggest objection, and this goes beyond just minor leaguers using that time to create content, I think this is top to bottom in baseball, is that baseball is a very mental game. And I think that, you know, it's easy to post and have fun and create content when you're winning and when you're playing good. But when you go through a, you know, over 30 stretch over a couple weeks, and then you go home and you try to post something, that's really hard. And especially if you're in a big market city, take New York or LA or whoever, in which the media is down your back, like, it's really hard to go 0-for-5 with 3 strikeouts and then after the game say, you know, great win, boys, let's get them, because there's going to be a handful of people that post negative comments and everything else. And so
has those games. Even the best player, even Mike Trout, goes 0-for-5 with 4 strikeouts
and has bad stretches too. Like, I think that's the difference between basketball and football. And another difference, I should say, with baseball is that in basketball and football, let's say James Harden goes out and has 10 points and, you know, 7 turnovers and has a tough game, he can come back and drop 30 the next night and then drop 30 the next night and then 20 and then 40. And so he's consistent. He's in a groove. But in baseball, if you're in a slump can last a month, you know, and if your team's not winning and you're not hitting, like, I think that's where guys need to separate being influencers and content creators and being baseball players. And I think that you know, it's really, really hard to separate that. And with baseball being so mental, it's hard to stay positive and keep your online persona and keep, you know, capturing photos and videos on your phone and, you know, put up with the negative comments. It's just really hard, and it's hard on the mental. And I don't think any baseball player has really been able to figure it out to this point. And I think, yeah, again, you know, Bauer is probably doing the best, but it's because, you know, he's found ways to just block that out. And he really, truly doesn't, you know, really care what people think about him. He's going to do him, and he's going to work on his personal brand. And, but he's, you know, he's one in a million at this point. So we just, it's just going to be a culture shift, you know, from guys that can block out that mental side of the game and be able to just focus on, hey, I'm a baseball player, you know, by night, and I'm a content creator by day. And there's just not a lot of people that have been able to do that.
That's so insightful. And we're seeing more emotion nowadays in sports, in baseball, but it's typically the positive stuff. It's the bat flipping. It's the taunting. It's the savagery that social media loves so much. And it's a lot harder to have those vulnerable moments when you are, you know, feeling human emotions and you are going through a tough stretch, and social media managers that work for teams even understand that they're not posting as much when the team is losing, just as much as a player wouldn't want to post as much when he's not performing at his best and the team is not performing well as either.
Yeah, and I think that you bring up a great example. Like, almost every team posts their lineup card pregame, right, on social media. And if you look at the comments, if they're winning, it's great. If they're losing, it looks terrible. But a lot of times, even now, those posts are being sponsored. So regardless if the team's playing good or bad, they're going to post that lineup card. And you grow to expect that, and you grow to expect the responses that come with it. And that's just part of the game. But that's a perfect parallel, right? Like, teams are using that consistency to attach a brand to it and monetize it, whether they're winning or losing. And, you know, fans have just come to expect it. You know, every game they're going to get this lineup card, and some people are going to say nice things, some people are going to be mean. And I think, you know, that's a big difference with players, right? Is like, consistency is key, and it's so hard to be consistent when you're a player and you're a real human and you have emotions and you're up and down. And that's the biggest thing, is consistency and just building a schedule for yourself and staying to it in the good times and the bad. And the fans will grow accustomed to it, and your followers. And it's just, you got to be hard-headed and you got to really want it. And a lot of times people want to be good baseball players more than they want to be TikTok or Instagram famous. So, right. Which is totally understandable. So I think, you know, those are all the battles we fight every day for sure.
No, that's huge. That's so interesting to think that, like, when a player comes and signs with Octagon, part of the job is go out and be the best damn ball player you can be, because, you know, hopefully that second, third contract comes along, you're signing an 8-9-figure deal. But another part of that is, hey, you know, you have an opportunity to really make a lot of money through your digital and social media, and that lasts beyond your career. So you're kind of serving two masters. And yes, if you're taking extra BP, that helps it helps you maybe play better on the field. But also, if you're posting more consistently on social and getting better at social, it also is helping you make more money at the end of the day. So definitely those not competing goals, but goals that should be looked at side by side, and becoming a well-rounded, you know, athlete and individual, and ultimately someone that's a quasi-influencer, I guess, on both sides of the coin.
For sure. And 99% of the guys so far will lean towards the baseball element of it, you know, more than they will the social and the influencer side of it. So I think it's just changing the narrative. And I think as the game gets younger and as Major League Baseball players, you know, get called up who have grown up with social media their whole lives, they're going to be a lot more comfortable with it. So I'm really positive about the future of the game in that regard. You know, guys being more active on social and open to it and posting and, you know, everything we're talking about, I think is going to be changing. So I'm feel really good about the future of the game in that regard, like, you know, where the players are and where the players are going. But historically, all these guys are baseball players first and Instagram users second. And I think that's going to change in the future. So it's just, I think to this point, it's just kind of been an age thing and a comfortability thing and a clubhouse thing. But as all of that trends younger, I think we're going to see a lot more acceptance with social and everything we're talking about for sure.
Really good stuff from JB Greer. Just an awesome conversation there. I highly recommend going back to the full thing. Just a lot of good ideas, really good insight. I mean, first-person insight, of course, from JB on what it takes to create and develop athlete brands, in particular the challenges in the baseball space, and some cool ideas there. Just cannot say enough good stuff. An awesome conversation with JB.
Next up on the Best of Digital Social Media Sports Podcast, I really enjoyed speaking with this next guest. It's a fantastic conversation. Felt like talking to a friend. You're going to hear from Emily Miller. When we spoke, she was at NYRA, the New York Racing Association. Now she's at FanDuel doing customer marketing there, and just so much good insight on introducing sports gambling and developing bettors and also engaging current bettors. And you know, we're seeing sports gambling, sports wagering continue to just blow up across the U.S., and it's only going to continue to grow as more states come on board. And Emily has amazing insight into, you know, what works with converting these customers, what works with converting these consumers and educating consumers, let alone dealing with all the different regulations in each state as they come on board and how to market in and out of those states. And she's continuing to get a great education, I'm sure, at FanDuel as she continues to help them. And I'm sure learn more there as well. But listen up to this part of my conversation with Emily as we talk about all that stuff. And you're really going to enjoy it. Here it is.
We think about our marketing strategy as having three core objectives. The first being attendance, getting you to whichever track we're at. And inclusive in that is various different ticket sales offerings, which are different at each track, as well as during Belmont Stakes. That also includes F&B, merchandise, any sponsorship activations are generally more focused on you physically being at the track, but sponsorships are obviously getting more into the digital space as well. Mm-hmm. Then we also have a really great TV product called America's Day at the Races and Saratoga Live during the Saratoga meet. We're on TV almost every race day. We air on Fox and MSG networks, as well as a few other folks. So we really want to encourage you, if you can't come to the track, to watch us on whichever network works best for you. Mm-hmm. And then the third point of focus is NYRA bets. We want you to bet through us on your preferred track. You can bet through NYRA bets from anywhere in the country where it's legal. We're available in about half the states nationally. So the other key piece of our marketing strategy, and really what's evolved most over time, is how those three elements interact with each other. So even if you do buy a ticket to the Belmont Stakes and you're coming to the track, we also want you to sign up for NYRA bets so that you're ready to go when you come to the track. You're ready to place your bets and you don't have to go to the window. You can just do it from the comfort of your seat. Same with our TV broadcast. We really consider that a funnel for folks to sign up for NYRA bets. So our end goal is to get you betting, to get you engaged with the product. But if you don't want to bet, you can always watch on TV or come out to the track.
Totally. That makes a lot of sense. And, you know, ultimately, you know, the bettor has someone that's actively betting, especially on NYRA bets, has, I'm sure, a hell of a lifetime value for you guys in terms of revenue and data capture as well, and all the above. So what are those channels that you guys have to funnel someone into NYRA bets? You mentioned someone making bets at the track. You mentioned someone watching programming. You know, obviously that we can talk a little bit more about, you know, what kind of things you guys can do on social and content, and what that email cadence might be like to make sure that someone either converts into a bettor or bets more. And then also, I'd love to kind of hear about how you think about those fan bases. I mean, are there fans that are just horse racing fans that aren't bettors yet? Are there fans who are just trying out betting for the first time and need the education? And I'm sure there's others who are the sharps, who are like, just, you know, I want the nitty gritty. Don't talk to me like I'm a noob. So how do you kind of manage those various fan segments, and where does that funnel look like to move someone up that chain?
Yeah, those are great questions. First, you know, from the organic and the paid side, those two branches really work together. Absolutely. I think, you know, we have different strategies for each, but when we see something doing really well on its own on Facebook, maybe, you know, a video is really outperforming our standard, we'll maybe throw some dollars behind it for a boosted post, or, you know, whatever makes sense. So we're on all the standard social channels, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, Snapchat, not TikTok just yet. but it's on our radar. Mm-hmm. And then from a paid media standpoint, you know, we're heavily invested in digital because it's the lowest cost per acquisition, right? And there, we're also able to better target on a state-by-state basis, as well as by age group, as well as by every state's, you know, requirements for being a betting advertiser. We're very cognizant of that. So we're all working in tandem to ultimately get anyone who is going to convert to becoming a avid bettor to getting them there with Naira Bets. Now, that being said, there are plenty of people that are never going to sign up for Naira Bets, but follow us on social or watch our TV product or come out to Saratoga every summer with their family or friends. And that's fine for us. I think that's where, you know, we have those three marketing categories that we do give equal weight to, where we're offering a little bit of everything for everyone. We're conscious of what demographic is more present where. So for instance, our presence on Instagram leans younger and more female in terms of demographics than on Facebook. So, you know, our messaging is more catered to each one, and we want to make sure that we're segmenting as best we can and providing customers with the information they want. So we do have everything from Betting 101 content on our websites and our YouTube channel to more complicated betting tips, longer form analysis. We really offer it all, and we just try to get you directed to the appropriate channel to find what you're looking for from us.
Love hearing that. That totally makes sense. And is there a movement toward, like, when you think about organic social, are you guys like literally saying, okay, we know the betting audience is already pretty well informed on this channel, so let's give them, you know, a little more advanced betting talk, or this channel is maybe less comprised of the avid bettor audience, so let's do a little more of the storytelling. When you talk about like packaging content or sharing content across platforms, is it a lot of, here's a crazy finish from a race, here is a betting tip, here is a crazy betting story. What's in your arsenal when it comes to, here's what content we can sort of choose from, here's what content tends to work well, and then, you know, here's the content that is kind of bubbling up those various segments to get someone to, you know, get to the maximum of their relationship with Naira, whether that is betting or coming to the race or whatever it may be.
So we race year round. We alternate from track to track. And even though we're a year round business, things are very seasonal and cyclical with us, just like, you know, a normal sports property or a top four sports property. So we are always heavily into storytelling and always heavily into betting, but we're going to post certain things on days when we think that they'll perform better. So we race anywhere from 3 to 5 days a week, depending on the season. And what we'd like to do is really focus on betting storylines on race days. So what I mean by betting storylines is maybe there is a really crazy finish, maybe a super long shot won a race and nobody saw it coming. Mm-hmm. We focus on our graded stakes, which are our most competitive races. Maybe one of our analysts hits a really impressive ticket. They had a great windfall. We want to talk that up, of course. And then on days when we're not racing, which we call dark days, we really like to tell the more behind the scenes storytelling type of content, post that on those days. So whether it's an interview with a jockey, maybe who's a mainstay on the Naira circuit, or a brand new jockey just won their first race at Aqueduct, we want to tell those kinds of stories on those days, things that are more interest pieces and less what's happening exactly on the track. Because we want those things to really sing. We want you to know who's contributing to making racing happen. These are real people with amazing stories who have been involved in the game for longer than some of us have been alive. So it's a sport that really lends itself to storytelling, and we want to let that shine.
Let's there's a few different directions I want to go, but let's touch on kind of that storytelling aspect really quickly on a couple of ways. First, like who are these characters ultimately? Like are there characters in horse racing that you guys want people to develop connections with or emotional connections with even? Like are there jockeys that everyone should know, or do people look at it like that, where they're looking at a jockey just like they might look at an NBA player? Or is it more like the horse trainers, like everyone might know Bob Baffert? Like who are these characters that you guys do want to tell stories about, and how does that relate to, you know, the horse racing fan or the betting fan, the NYRA fan, and how do you want them to relate, I guess?
Absolutely. So I think horse racing really differs from a traditional stick and ball sport in the sense that our horses themselves are not necessarily going to have as long a career as a LeBron James, right? Horses might only race for a couple years and then go on to their next life, whatever that may be, in their career. So we focus on the horses because horses have their own personality completely, and we want them to shine and really stand out. But folks like jockeys, you know, there are jockeys riding who are in their 50s now. Like, that's a great story. The trainers are really important to our sport as well, and they have some amazing backstories and have really seen the world through horse racing, right? So we want to talk about that. There's also folks in the industry who have been, you know, there are people who've worked at NYRA for over 50 years who've literally seen it all. So when you're talking to people who live and breathe the sport and make it their livelihood, that enthusiasm is completely infectious. And we want to share that. We want to share that passion and really pull the curtain back so people can see what we see every day.
So super well put. Who ultimately is responsible, and this is a big picture question, I guess, but who ultimately is responsible for producing and telling these stories? Do you guys take it upon yourselves that, hey, we need to do this because the, you know, the horse racing teams themselves are not necessarily getting their stories out there? You know, a trainer, or they're not producing for their Instagram story leading up to a race, so people need to turn to NYRA to get that backstory. I'm thinking almost like in terms of NASCAR to revisit, you know, the connection you had in NASCAR, and how they have their racing teams that, yes, the track is posting, the league entity is posting on a given race day, around race days, and you have the teams themselves that are also posting, and they are running multiple cars, just like they might be running, you know, multiple horses, I guess. So are they producing content? Are the incentives aligned where everyone can benefit from that additional attention and content? Or is it really, you know, the media rights holders, and those are the ones who have incentives for content and storytelling, and the horse racing teams themselves maybe don't have that need or that push to do so?
It's completely collaboration based. So we, as NYRA, the property, definitely have a larger digital footprint than some of the horse racing groups, and we want to amplify their stories. So at NYRA, we work cross collaboratively between the press office, the TV team, the digital team, and others to really amplify these stories. We'll help produce packages because owners, trainers, everyone in the horse racing industry, we can't continue with the sport without them, right? So we want to amplify their message. I would say that different ownership groups are really leaning into the digital space in terms of self-promotion, and they're really wonderful to work with in terms of helping us get behind the scenes access and interviews and really helping us tell those stories. So we're all invested in getting the sport in front of new people and existing fans and really telling everybody who we are and what we do. So it's very collaborative.
Yeah. At the end of the day, like it helps everyone if the sport overall is healthy and growing, even if, you know, if whatever, a given horse racing team may not be trying to develop their own Instagram presence. If there are more horse racing fans engaged on Instagram or engaged on social, that is better for horse racing in the short term and the long term. And so it's, you know, the whole, I guess, rising tide lifts all boats type aspect.
Exactly.
And I think you see a lot right now where a lot of folks are, you know, like we can take Barstool as an example because of kind of the way that Penn Gaming brought into Barstool. And they're saying, hey, you guys have the storytelling down. We have the betting down. Now let's get people to come from your content into our betting platform. And it seems almost like you guys have had the betting platform down for so long and have come along with the storytelling. And is that your mandate that you helped bring in? How new is that to the sport of horse racing, to Naira as well on its own, where, hey, we need to invest in social media content. We need to invest in storytelling. We need to make sure that we have the people in place to cut clips from our shows and to package content, because it's not just the job of one person, of two people even. Like, how has the evolution been to get buy-in for that stuff and to be able to show that, hey, this does contribute to our funnel?
Yeah, I would say in the last 3 years, really, Naira's made a concerted effort to focus on content production, whether that's through our TV group, through social media, with a strong emphasis on our digital channels. Folks internally have really all bought into that because we know it's the way forward to really, really lean into content production and really grab what other entities in more traditional stick and ball sports have done for a long time, right? It's about knowing who that player is when they take off their mask or their helmet or whatever. It's about bringing people along and creating fandom and leaning into player-produced content. So I would say we've made a really strong pivot over the last 3 years. And personally, when it comes to the digital team and our group, as long as you can show that what you're doing is driving revenue, so if it's an email marketing campaign that's generating X dollars in ticket sales, if it's a concerted betting post that drives however many signups, as long as you're continuing to tell that story and connect those dots, you're going to continue to get buy-in from leadership. You're going to continue to get added resources, whether it's personnel or tools. So things that can help you clip the show and repackage it and redistribute it.
Yeah.
As long as you can keep telling that story internally, you're going to be able to keep developing your digital team internally.
Great stuff, being able to speak with Emily Miller. Again, she's now at FanDuel, then was at Naira. And also just interesting stuff about going into the business of horse racing as well and how they're trying to evolve with the times and continue to stay popular with emerging generations, investing more in content. Just a fantastic conversation overall. So listen up to that episode 184 with Emily Miller. Next up on the Best of Digital Social Media Sports Podcast, just a great, great chat I was able to have with Jenny Fisher. We talked about her time at Marquette, and we're doing great stuff with their athletics department in content, digital, social. Also what she did with the NCAA and the Big East and the WNBA at the time. She's since become truly one of the most important people when it comes to digital and social content strategy for the NBA. She is the NBA social digital on-site and content lead, does a tremendous job traveling all over the world with the league oftentimes to create content, traveling to all the biggest events and creating content. And Jenny just has great insight into doing that, into, you know, what it's like to capture moments and to be ready for it, but also plan to be ready. We also talk a little about developing the athlete brands and helping their strategies when she was at Marquette, working alongside some generational athletes there. Just lots of good stuff here from Jenny Fisher. So listen up to this part of my chat with Jenny Fisher.
As I grew through the ranks, so to speak, of the student workers, mm-hmm. by the time I was at the end of my sophomore year, they had promoted me to the head student because I think I brought a bunch of random ideas. We'll put it that way. I was like, what if we did one-off sit-down interviews with student athletes from sports that don't always get covered? And I was like, and like the first three questions will be about the sport, but then the last three will just be about who they are as a person.
Yeah.
And they were like, how are we going to do it? And I was like, I can do it. And so it's like, again, just like little things like that. So it got to the point where that became a thing and I was editing them. And again, this is where I also feel horrible for SIDs who don't have the help or who don't have creative departments at some of these schools, because like, you've got to figure out how to work with nothing, which I guess we all have in some way, shape or form during COVID. But like, I was like, okay, I'm taking classes where I'm learning how to like edit in Premiere. Like I can edit this in Premiere and I just need someone to set up the camera and I can help like do this. And like, obviously we all have iPhones, so we can also do that. But it was just figuring out like different ways to tell the stories of the student athletes, which was something I was passionate about, because I was like, everyone's going to come running for Marquette men's basketball interviews. Like the media is going to know Marcus Howard had 52 points. They're going to want to know about that. And obviously that's a big story that should garner the media attention that should. But at the same time, like we had women's lacrosse players, for instance, that were leading the Big East and doing all these great things. And it was such a young program. Like it was still, I think it just celebrated its 10th anniversary of being a sport at Marquette. And like, it's Marquette men's and women's lacrosse have been to the tournament like a handful of times. And it's just like, there's so many great stories. And this even goes into something I want to touch on later about like Gen Z and like having like a little bit of like social interest and just like, how do I want to word this? Social intelligence, I think, is a better way of putting this, where people just want to be attached to something that they want to know more about. And yeah. So it's a long-winded answer, but like that's how I feel like TikTok works and all that, and I could go down this whole rabbit hole, but I basically feel like it's just changed in so many ways, but the focus has definitely turned to telling your own stories and figuring out the best ways to do it.
Totally, yeah. It's about definitely going beyond the AP-style recap and a box score. There's yep. people in there, there's stories in there, and especially at a university, you want all those stories to be told, not just the ones that ESPN is going to also tell for you, with a Marcus Howard as an example there. And I really appreciate as well, I'm sure there's college SIDs, if any are listening, we're nodding in agreement with just the limited resources and time and people that, hey, you know, we can't be at the level that this other school might be that has 10 times the number of employees that we have. So it's also a matter, and I went through this, you know, way back when I was in college, of having to work with our SIDs on, hey, it's okay if we don't write a 3,000 word, you know, essay, when we can tell the story better if we spend the same amount of time on a video and or, you know, a multimedia portion of it and photos. And so it's about, you know, trying to understand what's the best use of our time. And also, to the deeper point, what's the goal of the athletic department? Is it to drive the most clicks? Is it to tell a well-rounded story of the teams, of the university, of the student athletes? And we could have a whole podcast just on these subjects, no doubt. And you got a great look into a tremendous athletic department there at Marquette.
Yes, exactly. And that's also what I love about where we're trending. Like more resources are being made available and like more people are shifting around their athletic departments in a way that makes sense for how to best tell these stories. Because like you said, like, and this came to mind when you were actually saying this, as much as I love Marquette men's basketball and women's basketball at that, I don't know how many times since I've not been in the media relations department that I've read any of the post-game articles or post-game notes, like anything like that. I go straight to social. And so I know the whole audience isn't 23-year-old girls that are recent graduates and Marquette basketball nuts, but it makes you think, like, are there better ways to package this kind of information and present it to people?
Totally. Yeah. We started doing like little nuggets and capsules and infographics instead of recaps. Yeah. I love it. And let's touch on men's basketball for a second, because obviously Marquette has a storied men's basketball program. Everyone remembers Dwayne Wade and Marcus Howard more recently, and a lot of good players over the years. I'm a college basketball nut, so I can go toe to toe. But when you have a national program like that with a player that is so nationally well known, how do you balance, you know, the other, like, hey, if you're measured on numbers, or if we really want to, you know, break the internet, let's do highlights, and more highlights of Marcus Howard and just hit him up all day. And how do you balance, you know, getting the publicity for the school, which is good for everybody, while also making sure that the other athletes are getting those stories told as well?
Yeah, well, I think it's something that gives a lot of SIDs probably a headache, because you have to tell the story. You have to, like, if Marcus Howard scores 52 points, that's the story and that's why you have to tell it. at the same time, there's 12 other roster guys on the entire team. And so you have to be able to balance and figure out how to tell each of their stories. And one of my best friends, she actually runs the creative and social for Michigan State men's basketball. Her name's Kara. And like, we talk about like ways that she does that and like switching up the game day graphics and whatever, because it's like time and placement of when things are happening and who's going off is super important. And so to follow that storyline, like, I feel like it was warranted with Marcus Howard so often. And then he just became so big for Marquette. I remember I think he did a good job with this as well, like telling his own story and figuring out where to play his cards. It was towards the end of his senior year where he started getting more notoriety for his mental health and opening up about like how he meditates before every game and like how much really goes into that for him. And like some struggles that he's had and things like that, it got picked up by the New York Times. It was a segment that actually a Marquette alum, Jen Latta, did a segment on ESPN about, which again, Marquette and the Big East are not ever on ESPN because they have a deal with Fox Sports. And so that's a whole nother story for exposure and the kind of stories that get told. But I think when you have a once in a generation, and I would seriously put Marcus Howard up there, when you have like a once in a generation type of player that changes the way people view your program, you just have to ride the coattails of who they are. Because Marcus Howard is, he's going to be a household name for like when I'm 40 years old, the way my dad talks about playing with Doc Rivers, like that's going to be me with Marcus Howard. And so to remember that, like, it's much bigger than just the moment and the time period that we are in, is the way that I think you justify when to play your cards for what guys.
And I got to imagine that the school and the coach appreciate the opportunity in front of them as well. Like, hey, we're going to be able, let's ride this wave while he's here. Cause you only get a kind of player of this caliber every so often. So we have to maximize the exposure for the brand, for recruiting, for donations. Like, how intentional can you be with that of saying, hey, this is our, let's put all of our chips in now, because now we're gonna be able to get those huge donations that we've been chasing, or that big licensing deal we've been chasing.
Right. And it's not even a way of like, sometimes I think people get it twisted between like, oh, you're just using him or like for ticket sales and blah. And it's like, no, like, I think when you look back at it, Marquette recruits guys who are, and this is Marquette's motto, be the difference, right? So Marcus Howard is a guy who continually gives back. Like, he cares about charitable efforts. He cares about those kind of things, and he cares about the school. And so to have that kind of buy-in, that well-roundedness of student athlete and who he is as a person. And I'll just add this little tidbit as well. Wojo's obviously a Duke guy. Duke men's basketball has some of the best social in the game. I mean, they're doing crazy stuff all the time. They just had a cartoon video of all their brotherhood guys. Like, it was insane. It's like these guys at a fake pool party drawn up as cartoon characters. And that is what I think in his mind, he's seeing all of this. And that's a standard that he would love his program to get to. Again, I'm just presuming. And that's something that, you know, recruits are looking at, and you know that guys are. So I think it's important to the head coach, which is always a great thing. And then once you go down the line, and it's important to those guys, and like you said, above to the school and whoever, it just works in your favor.
Totally. And having a good conversation here with Jenny Fisher of WNBA, and also doing G League NBA work on the side with Digital and Social. Really enjoying this conversation so far. I want to talk briefly. I want to talk as well about your time with the Big East and tournament and such as well. But first, I want to touch briefly on, just to close the loop on Marcus Howard. And I'd be remiss if I didn't ask about this, is the whole NIL question. And, you know, how cognizant was he in particular, being that household name, of the value of his platform, both of for lucrative monetary gain in the future, as well as just the fact that, hey, when you say something, when you post something, there's a lot of people that are paying attention to it. So, like, what was that like seeing him come to that realization that, hey, all of a sudden I have this powerful platform that can do good and can maybe do not good?
Yeah, so I think it's super important, first of all, to mention that I feel like NIL talk got so much significant traction right when I got to the NCAA in, oh gosh, that was summer of 2019. Mm-hmm. And I feel like before that, it was like still a conversation, but people were like, this is never going to happen. And then right when I got to the NCAA, of course, is when, oh, California and the Bills and all this stuff. And I was like, oh, this this is about to happen. Obviously, Marcus Howard was still at Marquette because he's 2 years younger than me. And so I was like, okay, like, and he's one of the first people that came to mind. But I will say, when I was at Marquette, I don't think it was like on the radar as much, just because people didn't think it was going to happen. And then all of a sudden, when I got to the NCAA, it was a huge deal. So honestly, I can say that from a distance, I can tell that so he obviously just signed his two-way with the Nuggets, and he's doing like AT&T ads. He had like some kind of sleep ad on his Instagram the other day. I talked to him maybe like 3 weeks ago after Marquette beat Wisconsin. I had him on my podcast and we talked about college basketball and everything going on. But I just think he like truly understands. And this is something I want to mention too, like Sue Bird and the W, I feel like, is really choosy with like when and how she does certain things. And obviously like the Glossier thing with the WNBA and how she was within that. And there's a lot of different ways for like great sponsorship and to earn money and NIL and everything that goes along with it. But I think being choosy rather than being like a loose cannon is something that I really appreciate within athletes. And I think Marcus Howard has been pretty choosy about the ways that he chooses to go about that. And so, again, I don't think it was as big when I was on campus, it's definitely grown, and you can see why that would matter so much.
Even beyond NIL, though, and beyond even Marcus Howard, plenty of athletes have thousands of followers on Instagram, on Twitter. Are they – and we saw a lot of that play out this past summer in many good ways with social injustice and people speaking out. And how much were the student athletes there, from your experience, really cognizant of, hey, there are people that are listening to me. I actually have a platform that I can do something with.
Yeah, well, and that's one of the biggest things. So obviously the timeline of it, I was at the NCAA. I was actually out at the Big East tournament. Like I mentioned, they had hired me on to run their tournament stuff. When everything got shut down and canceled, and flew back, and we were like, what the heck did we do? Like, what is our new, like, we were gearing up for the women's Final Four. Like, we had hired our creators that we were going to have on site. Like, I was doling out, like, I had every single graphic made before I left for the Big East tournament for clinches from conference tournaments for who was actually going to be in the NCAA tournament. And so going from planning for one of the biggest events in collegiate athletics to where do we go from this pandemic, racial injustice obviously rolled into that shortly after. And I remember something I did, and I didn't even realize it at the time, but my old boss, who I still talk to all the time, him and I were actually, he invited me to their NCAA Christmas party yesterday. So I popped in on that, but his name's Chris Dion. And every day we would check in and I would Slack call him and I would just be like, how are you? And he was like, you realize every single time we start a call, you say, how are you? And I was like, I mean, yeah, like I'm from the Midwest. I know we tend to be nice. Like, what do you mean? And he's like, no, like, I think that there's something there because like, we're wondering how the heck our student athletes are. And so we came up with the Skype series and we went through all of that. But the amount of, and one student athlete sticks out to me in particular, her and I are still in contact, Khalees Barton. She is a soccer player for Washington State University. She is one of the most incredible, I think she's only a junior also. Washington State was in the College Cup for women's college soccer, but I didn't even know her at that point. Obviously, we were in the same location for that. She had tore ACL, so she didn't get to play in that game and everything. But basically, someone had told me that she had started a Black Student Athlete Association at Washington State. And that would be a great interview for me to get and story to tell on our NCAA platforms. And I was like, that's amazing, first of all. And then I talked to her and she's talking about how like her mom is an author and like she starts talking about all the things that she wants to do and initiatives that she's a part of. And I'm just like, this girl knows the power of her voice. She knows how to use it. And it's like a prime example of like people that you just want to like cheer on and like hope that they keep telling their own stories. And I think I actually added her on LinkedIn the other day and she had like journalist and content creator and all. And I was like, heck yes, you are. Like,
that's awesome.
She clearly, like I said, knows the power that she holds and in the space and place that she's in. And so it's things like that when, like I said, it just makes me want to cheer people on. Cause I can like reach out and want to tell as many stories as I can. But when an athlete like takes the first step for themselves and is able to do it themselves, I think is a really powerful thing.
Love that. And shout out to Chris Dion, former podcast guest and all around amazing human being. Love
Heck
it.
Yeah.
Let's touch on that Big East the tournament, especially this past year, but just in general too, covering stuff for the Big East. And are you looking to, you know, cover things that maybe an ESPN or a Fox Sports is not covering, or what stories are you all been trying to tell? Is that this team is going to win and end up in the NCAA or end up, you know, clinching a title, or maybe they don't win, but they were an underdog. And like, how are you looking at storytelling from that perspective, as well as, you know, what you're trying to accomplish from tune in and ticket sales and, you know, brand equity? So I'm just kind of trying to take me inside your guys' minds when you're planning out content and strategy for an NCAA tournament.
Yeah. So do you mean from the Big East perspective and the Big East tournament or the NCAA perspective?
Oh, sorry. That's why I was misspeaking. That's why I got my words tied there. Big East tournament for sure. Conference tournament.
Yes. So Big East tournament. And it's also funny because like I had to like unwire my brain from the NCAA tournament stuff for this Big East tournament.
That's the challenge of bouncing back and forth. It's your fault for having too many internships and jobs.
This is what happens. I know. I can barely keep my own life straight, honestly. But basically, and this was part of my pitch going into it, I was like, so they work with STN Digital, right? And they were like, okay, Jenny, we work with them, they have all these graphics for us, we have final score graphics for after every single game. And I like looked at them and I was like, final score graphics for every game? We don't need that. And they were like, what? And I was like, our job isn't to tell the story of the score, our job is to tell the story of who's advancing. I was like, I think it's up to the teams to tell the score. Like Providence had 52, Marquette had 150 because Marquette's the best. But it's like, our job is to say Marquette advances. And our job is to provide the new bracket and to provide obviously all the information, like you said, tune and all of that. But I also wanted it to be in ways where it's like, we're at Madison Square Garden. First of all, it's like that's one of the coolest, most overarching storylines that you can play to. Like, it's the longest standing tournament in one location. Oh, and it's the world's most famous arena. Oh, and all of these teams are in big market cities. And this is college basketball, but it feels like a huge deal. Mm. And then again, the rivalries, the traditions, like it's just like you have so much behind you that you can build upon.
Those emotional elements too. Those more emotional elements.
Exactly. And I'm like, people care about the Big East tournament. Like this is one of those things where we just have so much to play to, like I said. And so my biggest thing was, what are our necessities? And I think every time, again, people go to, oh yeah, we need the final score graphic. We need this, 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 and this, because sometimes I think we've gotten confused with like the more content we have, the better. So like, oh yeah, an Instagram story, we can make an Instagram story file of this. And I'm like, we could, and we could even put something on the Instagram feed, but with the algorithm and the way everything works, like I'm sick of like scrolling on Instagram and it's saying 2 days ago first half frames.
Totally.
I'm like, can we think this through? Can we archive it afterwards? Like, can we do something different? But those were some of the things that went through my mind first and foremost. Obviously it was short-lived. I remember when it was St. John's and Creighton in what ended up being the last college basketball game of March, I didn't even look at my computer. I kept my eyes glued to the court because I was like, ingrain this into your brain, because this is going to be the last time that you watch live basketball until who knows when. And now that I think about it, I haven't seen a live basketball game since. I've done some on-site stuff for G League, but that's still the last basketball game I saw live and in person. But yeah, those are some of the things that I think about. And again, every brand, every audience is different. What the NCAA cares about is different than what the Big East cares about. I think the Big East also cares about selling out MSG every single night. So that was another big thing that we tried to blow up. But yeah, I had a whole plan. It didn't really get filled, but hopeful for the future that hopefully can do more planning in general, because I feel like I can't plan for anything right now.
Really, really good stuff. Again, that was Jenny Fisher. She's now with the NBA, doing social and digital. She's the on-site and content lead. Just really, really good stuff from her. And also continues to do a tremendous job with her Keep Showing Up, cause, helping to bring to light mental health awareness, suicide prevention. Just cannot say enough good stuff about Jenny. Listen up to that full chat for sure.
Next up on the Best of Digital Social Media Sports podcast, this is a fun chat. You're going to hear a little bit of my conversation with Marissa Mast. Back when we spoke, she was the VP of Brand and Digital Social for the Arizona Coyotes NHL team, was really behind a lot of their success there, doing some really fun stuff with the athletes, developing a distinct brand and connecting with fans there. We talk a little bit about the Bachelor Report, which was a fun thing that she was able to do with the players, and also monetizing social. Just some really, really good stuff overall. This is part of my chat with Marissa Mast coming at you right now.
I think what was nice was when I started, they really said to me, they were like, we love your entertainment background, like just entertain fans and like use social media to like bring more people in. And so I think when I started, social very much was still like a storytelling element. And it was like way before the production that it is now. And I mean, even game days, I think we mainly were just sharing assets on Twitter, like, and it was basically like live tweeting. It wasn't like this whole production of having graphics ready and photos ready and timing their arrivals and like everything that it is now, where it's such a, I mean, it's such a game day, such a production now. And so that's been really nice. And then I think having it evolve into more has been really helpful on my end, just to be able to continue to grow. But you're right. I remember being in my first meeting with ticket sales and just being like, I mean, I don't know. I have a journalism degree. Like, I don't know where to start with ticket sales. Like, this isn't something that I've ever thought about in my life. And now, obviously, that's such a big part of the fabric. And you're just kind of always thinking of different ways that you can really, I mean, here, I think hockey is the best sport live, and I love Arizona. So I think my passions of hockey and also living in Arizona has really helped me, because to me, it's like, why would you not want to come to a Coyotes game? Like, why would you not want to come see hockey live? Mm-hmm. And so I think that really helps then when I'm trying to like share that. And a big push for us in recent years has been influencer marketing and like having different people showcase what it is like at a Coyotes game, because we all know hockey on TV and hockey live are just two very different experiences. And so for us, it's all about like, okay, if someone's not physically in our arena, like how do we bring them there? And I think influencer marketing has helped us, because like we've had a few like mommy bloggers who say like their 7-year-old son loves it and like can't wait to come back. Or we'll have people do it like they're a date night there or a girls night and just kind of like showcase. Like, I think we're all always looking for different things to do. And something that I love about the Coyotes is that it is one of the cheaper tickets in the NHL. So I hope it's not something that you have to like save up all month or year to come to a game. Like, I hope this is something that you can do on a Saturday night for fun with your friends or as a birthday present or a Christmas present.
And when people don't realize too, the Coyotes Arena is right there in the middle of a bunch of bars and restaurants. So right after the game's over, you can go have the rest of the night out if that's what you're looking for.
Yeah, a lot of people do say that. A lot of people say like they're shocked at how much there is to do and like how fun a game day experience is. And so for us, it's like, okay, we'll go tell 5 more people about it.
For tickets, go to NHL.com/Coyotes. No, okay. let's type in influencer marketing a little bit, because I think, you know, it's been – there's been different iterations of influencer marketing in sports, in hockey. I think back to, I mean, heck, to age myself a little bit, I think back to the Lightning with the Bolt social captains back when mm-hmm. Katie Kauf and James Roy were there. I think even to the LA Kings and what they're doing with their the celebrity announcers in the Fox Sports booth. So when you think about influencer marketing, are you thinking about celebrities that are going to drive a kind of a big push of like, hey, this really cool person is there that someone that would be on E? Is it more about that, like you mentioned, the mommy blogger, it's going to appeal to a certain audience and let's go after each of these audiences? Is it to help people have just a fan's view of a game through someone that has a wide following? So what kind of builds up that influencer marketing strategy, and how has it played out for you with the Coyotes?
Yeah, so we actually separated this past season by micro, macro, and celebrity. Mm-hmm. And so celebrity, we've had like a few, like I think you know Frankie Muniz is a big fan. Yep. And Ari from The Bachelor, him and his wife Lauren came out to games. And you know, then when they're in their Kachina jersey and then People Magazine picks it up, like that's a lot of like awesome earned media for us. Yeah. So yeah, so that's definitely like, I don't think you're ever going to turn those people down. But I think a big part of our strategy has been more the micro influencer who lives in Arizona, talks to people who, you know, live in the Phoenix area all day long, and like really having them showcase what a game day is like and why people should want to come to a game or should want to buy the cute beanie and all of those elements that go into it. So not just not just showcasing the game, but we love when they show like the food options, the drink options, what they did before the game, what they decided to wear. And so usually like what we don't currently have like a paid influencer program. So it's really for trade, but we like to do like awesome seeds and then we'll pair that with parking and some swag, and not just swag for you, but for your kids if they're coming, or your husband, or you're bringing girlfriends, beanies for everyone, and trying to really do what we consider to be a fair trade. So we hope this is more than $1,000 value.
Yeah, and then is the goal to get them to both share on their platforms as well as you guys sharing on your own platforms? Is it like an Instagram story takeover sometimes? Like how does that work on a given game, on a game night, when you're trying to activate that that activation?
Yeah, and that's usually what it is. So like reaching their audience, but then we love to like amplify from our accounts to engage with them. And like also sometimes like provides opportunities where like that one mommy blogger that I'm thinking about right now, like people are like, oh, well, how loud was it? Was it really cold in there? Like what age is too young? So that then gives us an opportunity, a community management opportunity, to really go in and say like, oh, it's, you know, 68 degrees, wear a jacket, but you won't be freezing. You know, all these things that we can say that like, and have a one-on-one relationship with people that hopefully convert to become a fan.
I love that. It takes that from idea to reality. And I think a lot of what we're talking about too is, we're dancing around, is that, you know, it's not just a hockey game that you're selling. You're selling an outing, a social outing, an entertainment experience. Yes, there's exciting hockey on the ice, but there's also entertainment on the video board. There's great food. There's going to be fun music. There's a great atmosphere. And that's really what you're trying to tell across all these different social platforms and social activations is, yes, like get excited about a big goal from Oliver Ekman-Larsson, or a big save, or whatever it might be, but also realize that there's all this other stuff happening that can be, you know, there's something for everyone there, I guess, at the end of the day.
Yeah. And I actually was just reading that like the fashion industry is like predicting that like a roaring 20s where like people are going to want to like dress up a lot more and do all these things that we couldn't do in 2020. And I actually feel the same way about sports. Like I think we all have like had time to realize like experiences mean way more to us than material items. And so I think we're going to see like sports come back in a really big way. And I think we're going to have like stadium, when it's safe to do so, like packed stadiums. And I think everyone can't wait to like be surrounded by strangers when it's safe to do so, and to really have more shared experience with friends and family.
Hell yeah. Getting goosebumps just thinking about it.
I
love it.
Yeah, me too. Like I can't wait to like hear the national anthem surrounded by strangers again.
So we talked a little earlier about just the demand for content, the volume, but also trying to make sure that you're not sacrificing quality, that it's done with some strategic oversight, strategic insight, so you're not just doing things for the sake of doing them. So when it comes to content production for the Coyotes, first, how do you guys kind of manage the balance of, hey, this is something that, you know, that one of our coordinator can do, or a social media manager can do on their own, versus this is something that we should enlist our video production team to do, and, you know, take away some of the time they might be spending on an in-game element or a TV broadcast element. So how does that give and take work from a content production side, especially as you mentioned earlier, TikTok and Reels and all these different platforms have sprung up that demand more of our time and more of our resources?
Yeah. So I think the big thing for us is that we start with like a content meeting on Monday mornings, where we kind of like lay out the games, the stories, the milestones, and the community service, which has been like a really big part of our brand. Like, I think we really want to be like a brand with a purpose, and we want to showcase how much we are giving back to the community and really how important sports are to the fabric of a community, and so much more than just ticket sales and a game day. Like, it really is, I think, a huge part of the culture of a city. And so we, on Mondays, like kind of doing that rundown has really helped us to then say, okay, what are we going to prioritize, and what is the bandwidth we have? And we've been fortunate to have like a few freelance photographers who can sometimes go cover events where our social team's tied up. And then during the season, I'm a really big believer in hiring good interns and relying on interns. And I know that is not everyone's take, and a lot of people would never in their life dream of an intern hitting send from a brand account, but I've never taken that approach. Like, I've always believed in hiring really good interns. And I think ASU is like a lot of really creative people and like a lot of creative students. So we've been lucky to hire them throughout the years. And some of them have turned into full-time roles, or they've gone on to work for other NHL teams, which like makes me really proud. But I almost think of like our interns as like a coordinator level and our coordinators as a manager level. Like, yeah. I love to give more responsibilities than their job probably they originally thought. And I think that's like really helped us because we've been able to have interns create TikToks for us. We've been able to have interns run our Instagram story. And like a lot of these platforms where the age skews younger, I would almost rather them be talking to those fans than me or an SVP of marketing. Like, I want them to really feel like they're part of our social media marketing team and that they have a voice and a say and that they can bring ideas to the table. And for me, I think that's really paid off, especially, you know, when you're really in the grind of the season and you just need more people. It's been nice that halfway through a season, like, they completely understand how everything works and they're really part of our social team, and I'm always so bummed when we lose them.
Well, I love that. I feel like so much of a lot of time we spend is, or not we, but I at least spend is trying to study these younger generations and figure out, okay, what is appealing to them? Why do they like this influencer so much? And, you know, what can I learn from that? Whereas they're living it. They're actually like, they follow them because that's part of their lifestyle. And you have that intuition, that instinct that they've grown up with because it's always been part of their lives, that they can understand these platforms better than someone that's saying that an outside observer trying to master something at a more strategic level, I guess.
Yeah. And like, I remember last year we were watching a game and there was a fight and our intern was like, oh, there's a perfect TikTok sound for that. And like, I was just like, okay, you are like living and breathing and thinking in TikToks and I am not. So I'm so happy I have you. And I think like that's what makes a good leader, is when you can like really rely on other people and let them do their job and let them do what they're good at.
Love it. I want to talk briefly about just the brand of the Coyotes. I think, you know, you wear a brand hat there. You understand a lot about, you know, what you're trying to accomplish in all these platforms. And when you have an intern or a coordinator pushing send on every little things from copy to TikToks, it's all part of the little things that make up a brand perception, especially for the segment of fans that may only follow the Coyotes on social. And that's the only touch point you have with them. Maybe outside of them coming to games every now and then as well. So what's it like to, whether it's from season to season or just an overarching strategy since you've been there or in the longer term, what does it mean to have a brand for the team and have it play out on social, whether it's, you know, strict guidelines, here's what we sound like, here's what we do in these situations. You know, what does it mean to actually document or convey what that brand is and how it should look on all these platforms?
Yeah, so I think like that's what's really cool about working in social, is that I've always said like social media is the front door of your brand. And I think like given the pandemic in 2020, I think even more so, social media and digital media and like email marketing and your web, like that's really, people have had to rely on that for their brand. So right now there is no in-game experience. So for those 9 months, like how are we conveying our brand and how are we staying in touch with our fans and staying relevant and still entertaining? And especially like, I felt like a lot of pressure in 2020 that I think sports provide happiness and can provide a laugh and can provide like a distraction from your day to day. And so I think like a lot of our brand has relied on social and digital to convey that. And so I think like for us, like, we've been able to really evolve our brand on social. And I think a really cool part has been able to like bring back the Kachina and the Kachina jersey. And I think, you know, there's been studies about how like Gen Z like loves throwback and like loves making what's old new again. And so I think in a lot of ways, like the Kachina jersey has been like a huge brand win for us. And then also like, you know, still using our other logo and using both. I think one has been allowed us to like have a more serious tone and one's allowed us to have more fun. And I think really getting back to that fun element on social has been important to us.
That's really well put. And I look at the Coyotes too, over the last few years, there's been, you know, the times when the team has struggled and has not made the playoffs. And then there's times when the team is in really the last couple of years, team that has been much better and very competitive. And you've had the excitement of a Phil Kessel coming in. You've had the excitement of a Taylor Hall coming in. Yeah. So when, as you manage sort of the ebbs and flows of the team, the amount of just excitement there is built in because the team is performing well, how does that affect how you guys, you know, strategize at the social level? Are there times when you're like, hey, this is our season, or hey, we just acquired Taylor Hall. Let's make the most of this. This is the time for us to turn those casual fans that may have been to one game into more avid fans that are, you know, live tweeting with us, that are going to more games. What's it like to have those moments of, this is our time to capitalize?
Yeah. So I think like one of the best things is like, we always go into the season with like a lot of series or elements of just entertaining fans. So that way, like, should you have a 5-game losing streak, like, we've always taken the approach that we don't need to rely on wins to have quote unquote good social media. And so I think that at the end of the day has like really helped us that we've had that for so many years that we've been able to like think creatively and think like a media company or an entertainment company. And so we've been able to do things like the Bachelor Report or Home Trippin'. Yeah. And that's allowed us to entertain our fans and get really at the end of the day, give people a reason to follow us besides just in-game action. And then as the wins come, which everyone knows, like, they will come eventually. So we've been able to, the past few years, have a lot more fun with that. And, like, win engagement is very real. And we've been able to, I think, capitalize on that. And I think, like, they always say, like, becoming championship ready, like, internally is something that we've been able to do on our social team is where I think we're really ready and prepared for that opportunity because we've been through the losing seasons. And so we know how to have like a really good balance of pure entertainment and then hockey content and how to use that hockey content to also entertain. And like you said, I think the casual fans do come when you're winning. And so to me, that's a really important time that you almost can't like overshare. I think, you know, constantly sharing highlights, recapping a hat trick the next day, like, there's no such thing, I think, as like oversharing good news and really capitalizing on those opportunities. So like playoffs for us was such a fun time. It also was like, you know, August where it's 110 degrees out. So I think a lot of people were spending more time on their phones and also in the middle of a pandemic, just not as much other distractions. And so I think we were able to really use that time to bring in some casual fans that hopefully when we start up again in January, we'll be there and continue to grow.
Lots of good stuff. Speaking with Marissa Mast, she's now working in the brand space, doing a brand, working with brands and public figures, doing social for them. She previously spent time with DoorDash as well. Then, of course, her long stint with the Arizona Coyotes. Really, really good chat with her. Just can really put into words some complex thoughts and ideas and give some great examples as well of those ideas in action. So highly recommend that full episode. Check it out, episode 187. Let's keep going on the Best of the Digital Social Media Sports Podcast with my next guest. You're going to hear a bit of my chat with Kareem Fatih. He was VP of Digital at Sport5, major sports agency, sports marketing agency, working with brands and teams and leagues, helping them to maximize their marketing, in this case digital for Kareem. And we talked in this part of my chat about fan development, about thinking about what makes fans tick, what makes fans fans in the first place. And Kareem just speaks that to it like an academic, almost being able to pick it apart, but he has the first party insights and first person insights of putting into action as well and seeing what works and what doesn't work. We also talk a little about localizing content. Some of the Sport5's work, as you'll hear in the interview, is from their work with helping overseas clubs adapt to other markets to build fans here. For example, with Borussia Dortmund, they are a German football club, very big overall in the world, and they have built a sizable following in the U.S., and that's largely thanks to the work of Kareem and his colleagues. So listen up. It's a really, really good chat. You're going to hear just a little bit up here with Kareem Fatih.
The goal is obviously to engage with fans, but it doesn't stop there. There's definitely an aspect where you have to consider the like fan lifetime value and how much time they're going to spend on your platforms. And the more time they spend and the more loyalty they kind of give towards that property, then you can measure obviously the retention and how can they continue to be engaged and continue to be in that ecosystem, whether it's starting from your social platforms to your website and then to your app. So a lot of people realize that, a lot of people realize the value that they can generate from that, from a fan growth perspective, from a fan engagement perspective, from a fan monetization perspective, but also from a brand side in terms of generating additional revenue from a brand perspective as well in order to reach those fans. So once you combine both together, you realize that, yeah, there's definitely a substantial revenue generation aspect that comes out of it. And obviously doesn't compare to media rights, for example, where the money flow is way, way bigger than that. And as well as the like overall like big sponsorship deals. But you've got to think that, again, the dynamics are shifting. And one perfect example is that when the pandemic happened or started back in March of 2020 and there were no live sports at all those properties and brands realized that there's no way to engage with fans except through social platforms. That was the only means of communication right now, the only means to reach the fans. And that way, a lot of those properties and brands accelerated their digital transformation, or to really invest heavily on digital and social and content creation and a lot of fan engagement techniques. Because, yeah, like the new normal is going to stay with us forever. Like things are not just going to come back where it was in 2019, for example. Obviously, albeit things are hopefully going to be better, but that new normal is going to stay with us, and that like focus and shift on digital is going to continue and is going to grow even bigger in the next 5, 10, 15, 20 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I want to take a step back in that vein. I think this came out even stronger during the pandemic, is that in some ways, you know, for a while there, brands were still seen as, we're in exchange for giving you this good content, you're going to sit through this commercial, or, you know, you're going to see this ad as a pre-roll, or it was more of an interruptive as opposed to an additive. And now we're seeing, you know, it's certainly more, and I would love to hear how this has evolved in the European space as well, because I think it has evolved in a different way, maybe less so on digital, has been maybe a little more uniform with the States, but this notion of partnership, and meaning that one, the property is going to benefit as much as the partner is, and we'll get more into that, but two, there is the partner's adding value for the fan as opposed to interrupting it or taking away from it. And during the pandemic, that even became a stronger thing, where it was almost not about the marketing message at all and more about the purpose-driven message, whether that's a health-related PSA or social injustice PSA, or here's what we're doing to help everyone that's battling this pandemic together all throughout the world. So how has that notion of working together for a common goal affected the way partners and properties work together, and making sure that we're serving the fans? And then even more lately in the last year, that purpose-driven element and making sure that brands are there with a larger purpose than just selling product or getting their word out there about their product. How has that come about in the last, you know, recent history, really?
Yeah, I think it was there in like last 3 or 4 years. It existed. Not a lot of brands really put an emphasis on it, as it was just an extension or a bucket in terms of the different aspects of how they're reaching or engaging with fans. But obviously, as we've seen over the past year, and specifically since the pandemic has happened, and the notion of togetherness, and we're all in it together, and we all need to like stand through this difficult period of time and support each other. And obviously that reflected as well in terms of the marketing campaigns of those different brands, in terms of also the properties specifically, because when you think about it, like fans to properties or teams, the affinity level is way, way higher than an affinity of an individual, an average consumer towards a brand.
Yeah.
So properties or teams had to like invest even more in terms of really showcasing that during that difficult period of time, because a sports team for a fan is a way or an escape to get away from like the everyday life troubles or issues, or just as a relief to really enjoy it. Obviously, some don't when a team loses all the time, but considering it, like it's also something that a fan always seeks for. So brands obviously have been playing an active role over this past year around that specifically, like cause-based marketing and messaging around all those different elements, social injustice, racial equality, obviously the pandemic efforts in terms of like fundraising, in terms of helping one another and helping people in need. All the food banks and the shelter elements, all that combined, it's been a heavy push over the past year specifically. I've seen it before, but like obviously no way compared to what is going on right now or in 2020.
Yeah, it really became like, let's work together for a common goal. And that's really some of the best parts of a partnership, is when you do share a common goal, which generally is, let's just enhance the fan experience in some way. But in this case, it's also, let's help the world, help society, help our fans in some way. I want to break down a little bit too of what it means to be a fan. I think, you know, since you and I have grown up in this space, there has been, and maybe started before us, whether it's the NBA or soccer around the world in particular, there's certainly more of this superstar-driven fandom where You are a Neymar fan wherever he goes. You're a Messi fan wherever he goes. And there's still, a strong sense of club fandom in particular in maybe the EPL and some other clubs out there. But especially given your role in working with a lot of these very internationally driven clubs that have fans all around the world, has there been, and this certainly comes into play with how partners may activate with a club versus a player, how has that changed the way that you guys and your clients go about working with brands, working with teams, working to engage fans when it comes to, are you building the identity and that fan engagement aspect around fall in love with the players, or still more about, you know, identify yourself with Team Crest, with that club name that's been around for, in some cases, centuries?
Yeah, so it's honestly, like, not the same in each scenario. Like, there's not an ideal recipe for success. It kind of differs from one fan to another, from one demographic, from one geographic, from one specific region or market, and from interest. And for me specifically, the number one thing that you need to think about before like doing anything is the association aspect. What kind of association does that specific fan have or can have towards a team? And that association can be, again, a player that they like to see, a player from their home country that plays abroad and they follow like all American players, for example, something around like family roots. They have a family history that supported that specific team. Mm-hmm. So they got to support it as well. Or they visited the city at one point, or the team is actually in the city that they've grown up in. So they have that natural affinity towards it. So there has to be like that sort of association. And for each individual, that association is different. Some fans even like support teams because they post cool social media content. And I've seen it a lot over the past couple of years where the content that a team posts actually drives more fans and grows your audience just purely by the actual content, not by anything else. So it depends really on a lot of those different factors. And the goal is to really try to find a couple of those factors that make sense, especially when you're attracting a big market, and just play on them and just make sure that you're consistent in the messaging that you're doing in order to not like create any sort of confusion or misunderstanding with those fans and really gain their support, trust, and loyalty.
I love that. And this is a perfect segue into, I feel like I've been bearing the lead here with a lot of the really cool work that you guys have done at Sport 5. And I mean, I look at a lot of what you guys have done to really, even you being at in Paris at one point, now in New York, and you guys are really helping to introduce a lot of these big name clubs all around the world to other markets around the world, whether it's, you know, having a club in Europe or in Germany, in England or Spain or whatever, being able to develop a fan base in the States, being able to develop a fan base in China. And I think every team now is trying to become an international team, an international brand, really, at the end of the day. So whether you want to talk through specific examples or just in general, when you guys are looking to, and you spoke to some examples or some ideas in your last response, when you guys are looking to introduce a club or develop a fan base for a club in another part of the world, what's that game plan look like? How do you go about starting to figure out what it means to localize content, to localize a brand, to introduce players, to develop fans, and how much does it need to remain true to quote unquote what the brand stands for in its home country, what it's stood for years, versus also, I guess, molding it into a way that's going to appeal more to Chinese fans, to fans in the States, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, I think one, like, it all starts from when you actually like see what kind of, as you mentioned, like the brand values of that specific team and what that team stands for, and how can you kind of relay that message in a different language or in a different way in order to attract a market from a different audience. So the tone of voice that you establish initially prior to actually like starting and kicking off is key. That tone of voice must obviously come from really understanding the current fan base that potential team or property has, and then also the potential fan base that you're going after. Because obviously the goal is to grow that fan base and engage it and continuously like have people turn from like casual fans to loyal fans to advocates at the end of the day. So really understanding how each kind of fan bucket operates. And then through that, you can establish different content pillars. Different content pillars where you really kind of lay out all the different means of content that you want to engage those specific buckets. And content pillars can vary from educational content, from football related or like sport related content, to trendy content, to cultural content, to CSR, to different like stakeholders, to influencers. So understanding really the fan prior to starting is very important, and it dictates what you do afterwards, and it kind of puts you on that path for success.
Is there that little bit of like how much of that is wiggle room or is flexibility to say, hey, this is what is going to work better with American fans? So will we lean into one pillar over another for a given market? And then how much of that can you really deviate from, you know, what the club overall wants to stand for? And like, we may see, I don't know, you can tell me whether there's a lot of sarcasm and snarkiness and gotcha type stuff when it comes to fans of clubs in Europe or abroad, or if that's more of a US thing or a North American thing. And then if so, how does that play out where you're like, hey, this is going to drive the quote unquote numbers and engagement in one market, even if we're going to have a different tone, different language, or different personality in another market? Or does it really need to have a good bit of consistency to have that, that brand integrity throughout?
Yeah. I think the goal is also like trying to really understand, once you understand the brand values and the messaging that property communicates in your local market, the path to like really going after those fans is how can you communicate, or how can you translate, not literally, but how can you translate that messaging to really fit that other market that team or property is going after? Because if you're just going and posting the exact same type of messaging that might work over there, does not necessarily mean that it's going to work in that market. What works in Europe is not 100% going to work in the US, and vice versa, and similar to Asia and similar to Africa. Obviously, there are like a lot of consistent things across the world that, like, you know, like anyone's probably going to like that. But then there are like specific elements that only that market is going to understand. So a big part is really understanding how can you translate and relay that message in a way that resonates with the fans best. And it's not easy. And it's not easy at all, because it requires a lot of research. It requires a lot of hands-on. It requires a lot of work and understanding of both the team and that local market that you're going after. Mm-hmm. And understanding both and combining both together is the way to really engage with those fans.
How do you guys go about learning about a given market? What does that research and digesting it look like? And it's one thing just spending time there is one thing, connecting with local influencers or local fan clubs. What kind of questions do you ask? What kind of profiles do you want to build? What kind of personas do you try to, like, what is the actual process to say, hey, we're going to introduce this club, this team, we're going to maybe have an event in this city. Let's figure out how to localize our brand, our team for this location, for this market. What goes into that? What goes into building that? To take me through the process a little bit.
Obviously can't share the full process.
Right. As much as you can.
No, but like I would say like a couple things. I'd say like data plays a very big part of it in terms of utilizing social listening and social monitoring and the social analysis tools to really understand the fan base in that market, the current fan base in that market, and also the landscape as a whole in terms of how that market looks like. What do fans like? What's their preferences? What's their consumption habits? What devices do they use? What kind of content do they consume? Because, for example, like if you're talking about like going after the African market versus going after the American or the North American market, the devices that they use in Africa are not the same, and the internet bandwidth is not the same. Yeah. Likewise in Asia. In Asia, you're talking about specifically like in China, where Facebook and Twitter are blocked, and you've got Weibo and WeChat and other platforms like that. So, and the platforms differ from one another. So it's really understanding all of those elements around the fan that's one thing and it's key, but it's not the only thing. If someone tells you like, yeah, we have that data-led approach that's gonna lead to X amount of engagement and generate X amount of growth and fan affinity, that's great, but it's also bullshit because there's a human aspect to it that is never gonna be substituted no matter what, no matter how, in my opinion, and I might be wrong in 15, 20 years from now, but no matter what AI or machine learning or Internet of Things or any buzzwords that you wanna put, are going to actually generate or pump out content or push out content that's going to engage with fans. You've got to have that human aspect of really combining all that data you have and the understanding of the market and the sport and the landscape and the players and the team and all that stuff in order to really come up with an engaging way to reach those fans.
Great, great stuff. Being able to learn from Kareem, just tons of good knowledge. Again, really insightful and articulate. Love being able to hear him put these complex ideas into explainable words, and you really learn a lot. I sure learned a lot from that, and I still remember a lot of those ideas today as I think back to that chat with Kareem. So if you enjoyed that part of it, listen up to the full episode. Highly recommend going and checking that out. Last up on the Best of Digital Social Media Sports Podcast, this was a great one to end on. Just cannot say enough good stuff about this guy. He is truly a great leader in the space. He brings up others around him, raises the tide all boats, so to speak, and also just is a really sharp guy himself and helping this space continue to evolve and get better. You're going to hear a bit of my conversation with Tyson Hutchins. When we spoke, he was still at Clemson. He's now back where he started at BYU as the Associate Athletic Director for Creative Strategy. And if you just take a second to check out BYU Social, check out their content, and you're going to hear some insight here into how he thinks about the frameworks, how he thinks about strategy, thinking about how to really activate the recruiting part of it, which is so important in the college athletic space, managing brand and content across sports. Just so much good stuff here from Tyson. I highly recommend checking out that full episode, but listen up to a little bit of it here. Tyson Hutchins.
For us here at Clemson and when I was at BYU, it was the same way. The lens that we try and look at things through is recruits, first and foremost. We found, and it's really yet to fail me for the most part, is that if a recruit likes it, most likely the majority of the fan base is going to like it as well. There, and so we start through that lens of how does this affect the recruit, and we go from there. And so the question that we're trying to answer all the time, every single day, and every bit of content that we put out here at Clemson is what it's like to be a Clemson Tiger. And so if we're telling that story and doing it in an appropriate way, and so that recruits have a familiarity with Clemson before they ever step foot on campus, we've done our job. And what we've noticed is that that's when that ends up being the case, the overall fan base, the country as a whole, the individuals that we're trying to reach outside of recruiting, also that resonates with them really well. And so, It's a trickle down approach that we've taken, and it's been really successful to this point. And that's not to say that at times you don't have to focus on selling tickets or sponsorship or anything like that. But when we kind of keep that, tell the story of what it's like to be a Clemson Tiger at the forefront of our mind, we seem to have a lot of success.
I love that. I was sitting here too thinking as you were laying out that that response now. I remember being blown away early on with Clemson football account on TikTok, and how you guys just did a tremendous job, whoever it was doing creating that content, of really showing the life. I remember a particular TikTok, I think it was, where you had almost like an athlete POV, and you saw from breakfast till bedtime of kind of just what that view was like in a sped up motion, like TikTok style. And so really, really cool to hear you put it to words and to be able to see it play out in that sense as well. I love to get an idea of how that maybe has evolved or become more multifaceted over time of what it means to have, like, or what that messaging is for Clemson for recruits, and to a lesser extent BYU, just because it's a little over a year or two ago now for you, of this. We won't talk about NIL like specifically, but I want to talk about your brand, for your future, versus, so there's messages of you're going to have a kick-ass time at Clemson. There's great food, there's great facilities, lots of parties and social life and stuff to do. And there's also going to be the
you're going to become the best version of yourself as a student athlete. If you want to play in the pros, this is the place that where you can accomplish that. And there might be, this is a place where you're going to be able to build a brand for life. So like, how much of it is, this is the best, this is an investment for your future versus this is where you want to go spend 4 years?
It's a good question. I, in my opinion, it's both of those things. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, it's all encompassing. We like to showcase and portray all that Clemson has to offer, whether that's great facilities, great strength and conditioning, obviously great coaching and great on-field performance and all of those things. But then also we're going to show you our PAW Journey program within the football department, which is the professional development group that, you know, they set up micro internships for our scholar athletes and are able to give them a lot of professional opportunities. And now we're getting into the, as NIL approaches, we begin to think about, you know, how can we help leverage your brand while you're here at Clemson and kind of the fruits that will come by being a part of a program like ours and having access to the resources that we do and that we offer. And so, you know, for us, it's all encompassing, I guess, is there's not one aspect of it that we kind of put more emphasis on more than others. We're trying to showcase the all encompassing reality of what it's like to be here.
Love that. Yeah. And obviously you're surrounded by real human stories. I mean, story, nothing more important on social than powerful storytelling. And you guys have at your disposal, you know, hundreds of student athletes that are living out these stories that you guys are telling. So when you guys are looking to activate with student athletes, take me through the process of how you guys both find the story to tell within Clemson athletics, who wants to work with you as far as the students in terms of like, hey, you, someone might be an elite performer, but they may be a little bit bashful about being on camera or telling their story or being featured. And there might be some element with the coaches having input. So like, what goes into you guys identifying the stories that you want to amplify, as well as then how you go about executing those in a way that is comfortable and beneficial for the student athletes and the teams, as well as for the best content you guys can produce?
For sure. You know, one of the things I love about Clemson, and it's a credit to those who have come before me. I have been able to yield the fruits of all of the people who have come before me and built these relationships. But one of the things I love about Clemson is very rarely do I have to sell something to a coach, to an administrator, to a department. They understand the value of what we do. And that's come from years and years worth of Jonathan and Jeff and Nick and our entire department, like putting emphasis and value on telling these stories. And so one of the things that I love about Clemson is that very rarely do we have to really sell something. You know, the folks who are here, they're bought into what we're doing and the role that it plays. And that allows us to do some really cool things where, you know, from the players to the equipment staff and everyone in between, they know that what our function is and how we can offer value to the department. And so when that's the case, they don't hesitate to let us know when there's a good story that needs to be told. Or, you know, one of the things that I really enjoy is I think in a lot of places, you know, there might be 2 to 5 people that really come up with the storylines that should be told, you know, from an athletic department. At Clemson, I think that number is probably somewhere between 10 to 20 of people who feel comfortable and confident pitching and talking about stories that should be told here at Clemson. And I think that's one of the reasons why you see the great content that we're able to produce. It's just because there are so many people thinking about how we can leverage and talk about the stories that we have at our disposal.
How does that play out? Is that like SIDs on a with you guys on a Slack channel saying, hey, yo, or even creating a list at the beginning of the year saying, hey, this player helped this student athlete helped do COVID research over the summer before the season started. This student athlete was in Antarctica doing research that was really interesting. We should talk about that. Like, how do these come to the surface so you guys even have those at your disposal?
Yeah, it's a good question. There's definitely a little bit of that, you know, kind of the traditional You know, SIDs making lists of great stories within their teams. There's definitely an element of that. There's also the recruiting element. We meet with our recruiting department within football every single week.
Yeah.
And they're very aware of a lot of things going on and great stories that we can tell or aspects that we should showcase that would benefit recruiting. And so I think it's a combination of things. Obviously, we try and have as great of communication as we can, but then also have those formal meetings where that's kind of the purpose of the meeting is to try and determine what exactly we should do next, who we should talk about, what we should talk about, things like that.
Yeah, that totally makes sense. And I'm always glad to hear kind of the inner workings of how the actual operation works, because it's always these stories don't come out of nowhere, and it's cool to hear that trickle down effect a little bit and the communication element, which is so key. When you guys are then looking at, I mean, not just the longer feature type stories and like student athlete profiles and whatnot, but just the everyday, hey, we're going to do a sick graphic because this guy had 3 sacks last game. And so let's do a really cool execution or a graphic that just showcases, you know, a player of the week or whatever it might be. Like, how are you guys ultimately judging success that, hey, we should continue to do these defense on fire graphics because they do really well and whatever that might mean, or our time and resources with our creative team is better spent doing this instead or spending time for this platform? Like, what ultimately helps determine when something is successful, you know, based on just the response of that recruiting audience and the general audience as a whole?
You know, I think like everyone, we're far from perfect at determining those things. I think we can be a lot better about applying our resources appropriately and things like that. But with that said, I think it's a combination of, you know, we at times will create something that we expect to do numbers, you know, just from a very generic social analytics standpoint, we expect it to perform and do well. And so there's that aspect of it. But then there's also the aspect of, we created this thing for a very specific audience, and we're going to get feedback about this thing from that very specific audience. Obviously, recruits is the one that comes to mind most often. Mm-hmm. But it might be, you know, Clemson alumni or season ticket holders or things like that. And we'll probably get feedback from them in alternate forms that may or may not show up in the numbers that we see on our social analytic dashboards. And so it's a combination of those things, I think, where we definitely pay attention to the performance of our accounts and what content works and what doesn't and how we can refine that strategy. But then also at times where we're trying to meet a very specific audience and we go to them directly, and we don't so much care about everything else, how it performs, as long as the answer that audience needs is there.
Totally makes sense. Yeah, it's a good way to think about it. Not everything is meant for every audience, and your analytics can tell you a lot, but there's also a lot that they can't tell you as well when it comes to that stuff. One question I have too, of some of that stuff that might be very less trackable, is how much happens behind the scenes that we may never see the light of public day, whether it's, you know, a text message sent to a recruit or a DM with a video or a graphic. How much of that is in college athletics in general that we may not know about, as well as speaking to your experience at BYU and at Clemson?
There's definitely a ton of that. There's a ton of that that goes on. We here at Clemson, we're kind of structured where in some roles there are internal creative roles and external creative roles, where someone's sole focus might be those types of internal direct communications. And that doesn't mean that they don't bleed over at times, but there's obviously a very big emphasis on that and the amount of communication that we need to make on a regular basis. And so and as far as I know, everyone else who's dedicated to kind of trying to build a creative and recruiting department like we are obviously focused on both the external but also the internal direct communication.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I appreciate you indulging me. I love the inside baseball stuff like that you may not know about that's happening behind the scenes. There's a lot more content being produced than you'll ever even see the light of public day, which is incredible to me.
That's very inside baseball. That is true. There's a lot of that going on.
A few minutes up here with Tyson Hutchins, the senior director of Crave Solutions with Clemson Athletics. I want to hear a little about just one more thing around kind of this Gen Z recruit, right? Ultimately, the recruits and the younger people that might be applying to Clemson as well. As you start to, you're still a pretty young man. As you get older, how do you guys try to keep up with the space? I mean, I'm sure having the student workers certainly helps, but when it comes to having your finger on the pulse of what that generation cares about, all both pop culture wise as well as what platforms they like and what how they like to consume content, how much of it is kind of trusting your gut, trusting what you how you learn outside of you know, whether it's external publications, podcasts, etc., as well as talking to students and trying to trust them and learn from them as well?
Yeah, that's a great question, especially as I get older. I ask myself that question a lot, where, you know, it may take me a little bit longer to be tapped into some of these things. But one of the great things that we have, and you mentioned it, is, you know, we have a great student workforce that is really tapped into a lot of great things. And so we try and make sure that we're utilizing them and not just, you know, giving them busy work or things like that, but they have the opportunity to create and do some really great things and be innovative. And then on top of that, we have, you know, hundreds of student athletes here on campus. And so we try and pay attention to the things that they're paying attention to. You know, what are they doing? Are they streaming on Twitch? Are they on TikTok now? Are they on Instagram? How much do they interact with various types of content? And we talk to them about it. Just this last week, we invited a player to be in one of our meetings to kind of hear what we're talking about. And they offered input that we hadn't considered and we should and need to. And so it's definitely an assortment of things to try and pay attention to the industry as a whole, but then also utilize these people that we have here who can offer so much.
Super cool. Yeah, it totally makes sense. You are, whenever I meet a young person, I always tell people, like, that's my mini focus group. If I have a cousin who is 22 years old, I'm going to pick that person's brain and see what's going on with the 22 year olds these days. Because yeah. As you get more removed, you definitely become the not boomer, not okay boomer yet, you and me, but I'm getting closer than you are.
Yeah, it feels like I'm getting increasingly close day by day, unfortunately.
I want to talk a little about being at Clemson. I mean, you are at like almost the mecca of SM sports in some ways, and making that move from BYU to Clemson as well, both in terms of the sheer size of the staff, of the budget, of the demand for content, as well as just the amount of national conversation that already happens around Clemson. Not that BYU doesn't have some national conversation, but not to the volume and degree that especially Clemson had during their championship years. Tell me about that transition and what it's even like to go to a program with a that kind of reputation, a well-defined history and fan base to a part of the country that you're not as familiar with. What was it like making that transition, and both in terms of resources as well as just learning their system and learning the school and the culture and the fans?
Yeah. When I worked at BYU, I went to BYU obviously and was able to get a full-time job at BYU, and I grew up a BYU fan and all of these things. And, you know, I used to joke around with my wife. I'd say, you know, there aren't very many jobs that I think I want other than the one I have right now. And then I would kind of jokingly say, unless Clemson like offers me a job, like I would like jokingly say that, like, that's a legitimate thing that I used to joke about. And so to know that, to then now being able to actually have the opportunity, I feel really, really lucky and really, really blessed to be able to work at and now influence a place that inspired me so much early in my career. And so I'm very grateful for that opportunity. As for the differences and how things have kind of evolved, you know, one of the things that I was very fortunate with as well is we had a very similarly structured department at BYU to what we have here at Clemson. And so I was able to kind of jump into that and very quickly kind of figure out some of the nuances of it and the differences, but also the similarities and get to work from there. And so, you know, there is a heightened awareness of just how many eyeballs we have on us and on our accounts and on our student athletes and all of those things. It definitely takes an adjustment, you know, where you got to really be on your toes to make sure that we're portraying the program in the appropriate light at all times, and our student athletes and everyone involved. And obviously there's a wealth of resources here at Clemson and a foundation established, and that's all great. But one of the things that I really pride myself on and try to is to just continue to build on that great foundation that so many of those folks who I've mentioned on this call have started at Clemson. Everyone from the students that we've had in the past who have now gone on to be industry leaders to the individuals who were full-time and have done various things, you know, that's what I'm really trying to focus on, is just making sure that I continue that great legacy of digital, social, all these things that Clemson has been known for so long.
Great, great stuff. Being able to pick the brain of Tyson Hutchins. And if you follow him on social, Instagram, Twitter, wherever, you will, and LinkedIn, you will continue to learn more from him as you see him continue to put that stuff into action at BYU. And he keeps on getting better with every year as well, and is sharing a lot of his insights along the way. And so definitely check him out. Check out that full episode as well. But that'll do it for this episode of the Digital and Social Media Sports Podcast. Thanks again for listening. This was an awesome best of episode to get your fall 2023 started, to put a date on this. Lots more good episodes coming ahead. Can't wait to introduce you to them. We have a little bit of a college football theme coming up with a couple episodes. So if you are into college football social, get ready. But until next time, this is Neil Horwitz signing off for the Digital and Social Media Sports Podcast.